Ayatollah Khamenei says a massive rally is held to mark the Islamic Revolution anniversary, prove Iranians fully support the Islamic establishment. Palestinians condemn new Israeli law, which requires the expulsion of Palestinian prisoners and their families, calling it the ugliest form of racism. And air travel sector in Germany is bracing for massive disruption after major trade union calls on airport workers to go on strike over pay. Hello everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. Leader Iran's Islamic Revolution has held massive rallies marking the 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said he found it necessary to pay his respects to the people of Iran for taking part in what he called historic rallies. He described people's participation nationwide as invaluable and a sign of allegiance to the Islamic establishment. Leader said nation's voice overshadowed adverse propaganda launched by Zionists and American media. Ayatollah Khamenei made the remarks in a meeting with people from East Azerbaijan province. Supporting terrorists and criminals is part and parcel of U.S. foreign policy. Now that, according to Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, who's blamed Washington for backing anti-Iran terror group, the Mujahideen Haq organization, the MKO. Nasser Kanani says that U.S. has been supportive of members of SABAK as well, a notorious intelligence agency during the Pahlavi regime. Kanani called on the U.S. to stop backing criminals and terrorists, urging Washington to also stop interfering in Iran's internal matters. On Saturday, an anti-Iran rally was held in Los Angeles, California. A photo shows a former deputy chief of the SABAK taking part in the gathering. He was involved in the torture of thousands of political prisoners over the years before the Pahlavi regime was toppled. Meanwhile, the U.S. Congress has recently pushed for a resolution in favor of the MKO. The infamous terrorist group has killed thousands of Iranians, including statesmen, in the early years following the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. Human rights activist Mohsen Naqvi says U.S. support for terrorists is simply aimed at promoting Washington's narrative.
Yes, it is quite sad that the United States of America, who claim to be the advocates of human rights throughout the world, are now basically supporting, have not since now, but since the very beginning, since after the Islamic Revolution in 1979, have been supporting all elements throughout the world who stand against the Islamic Revolution in Iran. There are not just this individual from SABAK, but there are many other war criminals that the United States gives asylum to. End of the day, it's not about human rights. It's basically a matter of who supports their narrative at a certain given time. The Mahsa Amini protests are an absolute, it's absolutely despicable the way they've used the death of an innocent woman to propagate their narrative throughout the world.
U.S. Central Command says it shot down an Iranian-made drone over Syria. CENTCOM claims unmanned aircraft was attempting to conduct reconnaissance of a U.S. oil base in northeast Syria. And in response, an Iranian military advisor in their country says it was a hand-launched unmanned aerial vehicle which was flown for testing purposes. The advisor added the drone's mission was accomplished. He said the drone cost less than $1,000 and while it was struck by an American missile worth thousands of dollars. CENTCOM made the claim as Syria has repeatedly voiced opposition to U.S. military presence. Damascus says Washington is looting the Arab nation's resources, notably its oil. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has strongly condemned a new Israeli law that facilitates the expulsion of Palestinian prisoners and their families. The movement says that Israel's law violates the rights of Palestinians in their ancestral land and is aimed at paving the way for forceful expulsion. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry also slammed the law as the ugliest form of racism. The Palestinian Prisoners Association has described it as unjust and racist and aimed to empty Palestine of its native inhabitants. New law allows the regime to strip Palestinians of their Israeli IDs or deport them to the occupied West Bank or the besieged Gaza Strip if they receive Palestinian funds. The Palestinian Authority gives stipends to families of Palestinian prisoners and detainees. The Jordanian Foreign Minister Ayman Safadi has held talks with the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. His visit was the first of its kind since foreign-backed militancy began in the Arab country back in 2011. We discussed the issue with our guests earlier in our news review program. Here it is.
Mohammed Ali is our correspondent from Damascus, who joins us to give us the latest on this visit. Massoud Shajra, chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, joins us from London for an analysis. Okay, Mohammed, first over to you. Give us some highlights, if you may, of some of the ongoings between the Jordanian foreign minister and the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in particular.
Okay, al-Safadi said that his country will continue to provide assistance to the Syrian people in order to overcome this crisis. He also said that all countries of the world should deal with Syria currently on humanitarian basis and principles. He said that assistance should be delivered to all Syrian Syrian areas affected by the earthquake without any politicization. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad expressed appreciation to Jordan, to the Jordanian stance and Jordanian support, and said the Syrian people welcome any positive step towards Syria, and also underlined the importance of the two countries. Now, if you ask Syrians or analysts here, they'll tell you that this is a very important visit. It's kind of a an indication of a lift of a political siege on Syria, as this is the first visit for Jordanian foreign minister since the start of the crisis in Syria. So definitely it's a very important step, and we all know that Jordan last year had an initiative calling on all Arab countries to take part in efforts to end the Syrian crisis politically.
All right, so Massoud Shajra, when you take a look at some of the countries that are involved in this, we know that the UAE and Bahrain and now Jordan and, you know, everybody is wondering when Saudi Arabia may be making its move. But, of course, we're looking at what this signifies, if you can elaborate on that a little bit more. But at the same time, shouldn't there be a cautious optimism on this whole thing? Because there is also a camp that says maybe these moves are made so that these countries take Syria away from the camp of Iran, as some may say. So that's one way also of you know, looking at this in a critical way, I should say.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, the reality is that these countries weren't bystanders. They were instrumental in creating this sort of havoc and supported the Takfiris, and they were part of a plot to destroy Syria as it was, and as a one of the axes of resistance. And when they weren't able to implement their policies and bring it to any sort of success, it seems that they have actually changed tactic. Yes, of course, it's good to see that they have given up the tactics of yesteryears, but we need to be very cautious of the tactics of right now. I mean, what they weren't able to achieve through havoc and civil war and getting Syrians to kill Syrians and to support them by terrorist groups and so forth and so on, and now they want to achieve the same goal. I don't think their goal has changed. I think their tactics are changed. But also I think there is another caution which I would say that, you know, in my experience, looking at the sort of this sort of situation, whenever there is flooding or earthquake of this level, there are huge the combination of countries. They come forward, they promise the earth and they promise everything, but in reality these promises, these pledges very often do not sort of realize, they do not actually turn to anything. They become only pledges to get publicity and you know, for internal and external publicity. So my caution is on those two levels, but I have to say it is good to see that their plots of yesteryears have come to no end.
Thank you for that, Massoud Shajra, Chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission from London. Mohammed Ali, thank you so much, our correspondent there from Damascus. With that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in.
Two dozen human rights groups have criticized Morocco's decision to extradite a Saudi citizen back to the kingdom, saying he'll face serious rights abuses there. A group said that Hassan Al-Rabi is facing a risk of torture for reasons related to his religious beliefs and the family's history of political dissent. Al-Rabi is a member of a family of activists from Saudi Arabia's Shiite minority. Earlier this month, a Moroccan court ruled in favor of his extradition. According to his brother, Rabi was arrested at Saudi Arabia's request as he tried to leave Morocco for Turkey. The rights groups say that he was extradited from Morocco on the 6th of February, but this has yet to be confirmed by the two countries. A kingdom reportedly sentenced Hassan's older brother Ali to death in November, allegedly for helping a third brother escape Saudi Arabia. France and China have agreed to work together to promote peace in Ukraine as intense fighting rages on in the country's east. An announcement was made following a meeting between the French President Emmanuel Macron and Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi in Paris. French presidency said in a statement, two countries have agreed to explore political solutions to the Ukraine war in line with international law. They also discussed the Ukraine war's impact on the most vulnerable countries, particularly in terms of food security. Russia and Ukraine have held several rounds of peace talks since the war began, but to no avail. Moscow has frequently expressed readiness to negotiate with Kiev with no preconditions. Ukraine, however, claims Russia is not truly committed to peace and intends to buy time for its forces to regroup. Passengers in Germany are bracing for widespread travel chaos after a major trade union called on airport workers to go on strike over pay dispute. 24-hour walkouts planned for Friday at seven major airports across the country. Verdi Trade Union has called for industrial action after it said that collective bargaining efforts to settle the wage disputes with the government failed. Now, the union added that the strike is expected to affect domestic flights in particular, advising passengers to find alternatives to air travel. Fraport, which operates Germany's largest airport in Frankfurt, also warned the strike will cause massive disruption to air traffic. Since last week, European airlines have been facing labor strife amid staff shortages and soaring inflation, which have prompted employees to demand higher wages. Hundreds of Rohingya refugees continue to languish in detention centers across India. As Munawar Zaman reports, their families have been urging authorities to release them on humanitarian grounds.
This is all they have to survive with for now. A little crumbling space filled with dirt and garbage. This Rohingya refugee camp on the outskirts of New Delhi is no more than an open prison for the members of the community who face constant threats and intimidation from law enforcement agencies. They say all their activities are being monitored and reported to the local police station on a daily basis. A member of the community is given that task, but that is not the only trouble. This woman says her son has been held in a detention center for months despite having a UN refugee card. With eyes full of tears and a numb voice, she revealed her ordeal.
My son was picked up by police along with his wife from outside our shanty 4 months ago. He did not commit any crime. He has been in a detention center for a long time now. I'm worried for him. The UN Refugee Agency says they are working on the case, but nothing has been done so far. He was working as a day laborer in nearby colonies. He did nothing wrong. I humbly urge for his release. We thank God that India gave us shelter, but there is constant fear of detention in the camp.
In recent weeks, the Delhi High Court ordered a joint inspection of the Rohingya Detention Center in New Delhi by officials of concerned agencies over the alleged lack of basic amenities. The court was hearing a plea of a female refugee who is facing bad health conditions due to the lack of basic facilities in the detention center.
My brother recently got married and he was detained just 3 days after his wedding along with his wife. Since then, he's in a detention center. My mother is blind and she cries every day for him. We have been living here for years and we are grateful to India for giving us refugees. I sell vegetables on the streets and similarly other men do menial work, but we are scared now since detention fear is looming across camps.
Most refugees here have heartbreaking tales of the past, and those memories of carnage and exodus are haunting them. Based on official estimates, India is home to some 40,000 Rohingya refugees, but independent reports put the figures at hundreds of thousands.
Most of the refugees I spoke with feared that their identity would be disclosed, given the high risk of detention. Scores have also gone into hiding at undisclosed locations across India. They have a horrific tales of separation from their families amid a persistent deportation campaign and an intensified crackdown against the community. Munawar Zaman, the outskirts of New Delhi.
UN is sounding the alarm over the health and nutrition crisis in Afghanistan. World Health Organization says tens of thousands of Afghan children and women will suffer from acute malnutrition this year, as Rahmatullah Baghban reports.
I am visiting a children's hospital in Kabul, which is said to be overwhelmed with malnourished kids. Every few hours, a sick child is brought into the malnourishment ward, while doctors and nurses are racing against time to save the youngest victims of Afghanistan's crisis.
Unfortunately, this year, undernourished cases, especially severe acute malnutrition, have significantly surged compared to last year. Constant hunger and poverty and differing diseases are to blame for this, which puts us in dire need of more supplies and medical aid.
As you know, Afghans are gripped with poverty and economic problems. As a result, we are overwhelmed with a huge number of malnutrition. We are running out of beds, and sometimes we are forced to reject new entries. Besides, childhood wasting as well as child mortality have also soared.
The World Health Organization says in 2023, around 17,000 Afghan babies and mothers are expected to suffer from severe acute malnutrition, while over 2.3 million children may suffer from moderate acute malnutrition. The UN body adds that an estimated 28.3 million people, which comprises two-thirds of Afghanistan's population, need urgent relief assistance.
We are a family of 10. My husband is a shoemaker. This malnourished child of mine is 3 months old. Two of my children died as a result of wasting and stunting.
Afghan people's miseries are growing day by day. Unemployment, poverty, and famine have gripped the society, with poor and middle-class households being hit hard. Many have brought their malnourished kids here, and I think it is because they have no food in their houses. We are calling on the global community not to ignore Afghans amid political and economic crises.
Concerns are on the rise among Afghans over their isolation from the international community and major cuts in global aid following the Taliban's takeover and U.S. withdrawal from their country. Afghanistan has one of the highest rates of malnutrition in the world. Afghans are calling on the global community not to leave them alone amid poverty and hunger. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A new survey has shown that economists consider the probability of recession in the United States to approximately 70% in 2023. Also, nearly 9 out of 10 Americans are worried about economic recession, while two-thirds of voters believe the country's economy is in recession. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Hill newspaper has covered the story. According to a survey conducted by the National Association of Manufacturers, 62% of manufacturers expect the U.S. economy to enter a recession this year. The survey also found that 69% of manufacturers have a positive outlook for their company, the lowest figure since the third quarter of 2020. They cited struggles in attracting and finding workers, continued supply chain problems, and high raw material costs. It's the latest warning sign that the U.S. manufacturing industry is slowing down amid weakening demand and higher borrowing costs stemming from the Federal Reserve's interest rate hikes. The Institute for Supply Management said on Wednesday, 4th of January, that manufacturing contracted for the second straight month in December and reached its weakest point since May of 2020. To add insult to injury, some of manufacturers' top priorities fell flat at the end of last Congress, including changes to taxes, permitting and immigration policy. Congress refused to scrap new rules implemented this year as part of Republicans' 2017 tax bill that require companies to spread out their research and development tax deductions over 5 years rather than write them off immediately. Large manufacturers, including Ford and Boeing, lobbied lawmakers to reverse the new rules, warning that they would lead to layoffs. Lawmakers also rejected a proposal from Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat of West Virginia, to streamline the permitting process for energy projects, a top priority for manufacturers that drew opposition from many environmental groups. The National Association of Manufacturers president and CEO, Jay Timmons, said in a statement, "Much-needed permitting reforms and provisions to strengthen our ability to conduct research and development, buy machinery and finance job-creating investments, which we need to promote growth within the sector, were left on the cutting room floor last year." The National Association of Manufacturers survey was conducted from 29th of November through to 13th of December and received 337 responses. The Wall Street Journal has also covered the same story. According to a new survey, two-thirds of economists at the largest U.S. financial institutions believe a recession will occur in 2023. The survey of 23 primary dealers, the large financial firms that do business directly with the U.S. Federal Reserve, found the majority expect a recession in the coming year. Among the top economic concerns cited included dwindling personal savings, the decline in the housing market, and tightening lending standards at many banks. It follows the U.S. Federal Reserve's rapid rate interest rate hikes to battle soaring inflation last year, which saw the benchmark rate rise from near zero in March to a range of 4.25% to 4.5% by the end of the year. The central bank forecast that will reach a range of 5% to 5.25% by the end of 2023. Its forecast doesn't call for a rate cut before 2024. The U.S. Federal Reserve policy rate is now at its highest level since prior to the 2008 recession, as the central bank attempts to bring inflation down without triggering an economic downturn. By the Fed's preferred measure, inflation is still running nearly three times its 2% goal, having risen earlier in 2022 at its fastest pace in the past 40 years. Rising prices have forced consumers to rapidly spend down savings, which soared during the COVID-19 pandemic thanks to stimulus measures and a slowdown in spending. the personal saving rates dropped to 2.4% in November, far below the pre-pandemic average of 8.8% in 2019. Consumers have also increasingly been tapping lines of credit to make ends meet. According to US Federal Reserve data, total household borrowing reached $16.51 trillion in the third quarter, a $351 billion increase from the prior quarter and 8.3% jump from a year ago, the fastest annual increase in the past 14 years. Higher interest rates have had the most dramatic impact on the housing market, which saw a plunge in sales activity in the second half of last year. The 30-year fixed rate mortgage breached 7% in October for the first time since 2002, more than doubling in the span of 9 months. It has deflated a red-hot housing market fueled by historically low borrowing costs and a rush to the suburbs during the pandemic. According to the National Association of Realtors, existing home sales fell 7.7% in November from October, and November sales dropped a whopping 35.4% year over year. The National Association of Realtors added that the current 10-month streak of declines is the longest on record in the data that dates back to 1999. Banks have also tightened their lending standards in recent months, a traditional leading indicator of recession. The British newsletter The Financial Times has also reported on the same story. A top International Monetary Fund official said inflation in the United States has not turned a corner yet, and it is too early for the Federal Reserve to declare victory in the fight on rising prices. Geeta Gopinath, a deputy managing director of the fund, urged the U.S. Central Bank to press ahead with rate rises this year. She said it was important for the Federal Reserve to maintain restrictive monetary policy until a very definite, durable decline in inflation was evident in wages and industries not related to food or energy. She added, "If you see the indicators in the labor market and if you look at very sticky components of inflation like services inflation, I think it's clear that we haven't turned the corner yet on inflation." The comments follow recent data showing that job openings, closely watched as a proxy for labour market shortages and pressure on employers to hand out wage increases higher than normal, fell only moderately in the month of November in the United States. Minutes of the US Federal Reserve December 13-14 policy meeting, published on Wednesday, 4th of January, showed that officials agreed that the central bank now needed to balance its fight against price pressures with the risk of slowing down the economy too much. In October, the International Monetary Fund cut its outlook for global economic growth in 2023, reflecting the continuing drag from the Ukraine war as well as inflation pressure and higher interest rates engineered by central banks to rein in those price pressures.
Food for thought.
Hello, everyone. Here are some words worth pondering upon from the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. Faith stands on four supports. They are dependence upon God, entrustment with God, submission to the decision of God, and satisfaction with the acts of God. This belief stands on four supports. They are the desire for the worldly pleasures, fear from missing any worldly pleasures, anger, and passion.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, strengthening the taqwa through abandoning the material things. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of ways of strengthening taqwa through abandoning the material things in the Islamic lifestyle. According to the Islamic teachings, it is said that in multiple cases, even in the Quran, that this world and the things that we have in this world, these are passing enjoyments. The word mata' is used in the Arabic language or in the Quran, which is said to be the passing enjoyments. Therefore, when we are living in this world, if we want to have the taqwa, we need to have attention towards the permanent sources of enjoyment, the permanent sources of sustenance, which will remain for us in hereafter. Therefore, the things that we have in this world, which is the material things we can say, these are the passing enjoyments. Therefore, we need to have this practice of abandoning the material things. And the material things that can take us towards the perfection, which are the means of getting to the perfection or strengthening us in order to get the spiritual peace, in order to get the spiritual power, in order to get the nearness of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. In that case, obviously, we can enjoy that. But other than that, if the things are a necessity, we must avoid them. We must be a kind of a person who is the waver of the material things. And this waving off or waving away or not to give much importance to the material things will take us to a level where we can achieve the taqwa, where we can achieve the level of being God very, inshallah.
Thank you.
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of ways of strengthening taqwa through the abandoning of material needs or material things. Now, we discussed that it is necessary to abandon the unnecessary material things that we have in our life. But basically, we can see, like, because we have a material body which has been made of dust, therefore we are inclined towards this world, towards the material things. And there are many people who believe in material and they think like the material is everything. But human body is not only consisted of this material, but also it has ruh, it has something which is related to something beyond this material, which is metaphysic, which has been discussed in the philosophy and the mysticism. Therefore, when we are looking at our life, we need to avoid anything that can take us towards the disobedience of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Why? Because all of these things that are material, which are in this world, that will not take us towards the perfection. Sometimes avoiding them will take us towards the perfection. For example, we are inclined towards many unnecessary worldly things. Therefore, it is not necessary to go towards them. Sometimes we exceed the limits in performing something. And sometimes, you know, people, they want the position, people are looking for the wealth, they are looking for the better position. And in order to get that position, for example, they are ready to do anything. In order to reach to the wealth, they are ready to do anything. And there are many other things. For example, we dislike others and we want to become famous. Sometimes we see that, you know, these people who are shooting at the schools, when they ask them, or they do robbery, when they ask them why you have performed such an action, they say, we want to become famous. So this popularity or going towards this material, we can say things, these are not taking us towards perfection. They will take us towards a place where we will lose this world and the hereafter. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
The Stories of the Revolution.
Part 1.
Tehran, Behisht-e Zahra Cemetery, January 2014. Each and every alley, street, and place has its own tale. Many of these tales sank into oblivion. Others are more important and remain in our minds, but the point is that people mark history with different kinds of tales. People leave their trace behind in history with their own good and bad conduct, so that there is always a tale to read and learn from. This history can have important or trivial parts, but it is the same history that is fundamental in creating important tales. Tehran, December 1978. The former Shah of Iran noticed that demonstrations increased in the last days of his rule, but he didn't take the news seriously in the months before the collapse of his regime. He always thought that he could find a way to stabilize the situation. But in the last days of his reign, he had lost his hope due to a massive wave of demonstrations. There were waves of anti-government protests. Savak and Imperial Guard could not stand against the countless Iranians who were demanding real change. Former Iranian monarch Mohammad Reza Pahlavi changed different prime ministers to find a solution to the crisis. Jafar Sharif Emami was one of them. During Jafar Sharif Emami's time, many tragedies like the Black Friday, 1978, and massacre of a number of Tehran's pupils took place. His biggest mistake was pressuring the Iraqi government to expel Imam Khomeini. Imam Khomeini was a revolutionary exile in Najaf, Iraq. Jafar Sharif Emami thought that when Imam Khomeini was no longer close to Iran, he could not be influential in the process of a revolution. He wanted to calm the situation, but with Imam Khomeini's expulsion from Iraq, not only his dream did not come true, but Iran and the Islamic Revolution became the focus of the world's attention. Imam Khomeini decided to go to France. Paris, January 1979, Neuf Le Chateau. When Imam Khomeini was in Najaf, people received his reports and messages late. But everything changed when he came to Paris. France was the center of news agencies and had famous reporters, and every message of the Imam was transmitted to Iran quickly. Foreign reporters recorded their first videos of Imam Khomeini in this house. From then on, people around the world, along with Iranians, were able to hear and understand Imam Khomeini's words. The entire world was following the events by hearing the news that it was coming from Iran and the messages that Imam Khomeini sent from Neuf Le Chateau. Soon, Neuf Le Chateau became the guiding center of a great revolution, while many French citizens hadn't heard about this place much before the arrival of Imam Khomeini. People from different countries around the world went to Neuf Le Chateau to meet Imam Khomeini and listen to him. The news agencies were also reporting the news moment by moment. Imam Khomeini's words were honest and logical. Journalists from all over the world had come to Tehran to see the reality up close. For years, the Shah and his paid personnel did not allow true news of the country to leak out, and they had created a civilized image of themselves and the government in the minds of the world, but the situation had changed a lot. Tehran, 1979, January 16th. The Shah appoints his last prime minister and leaves Iran. Then Shapur Bakhtiar had to face the massive waves of revolutionaries. Shapur Bakhtiar was a weird person. He knew that the Shah's reign was about to collapse, but he accepted the responsibility and then tried to form a government. In the beginning, he introduced himself as a revolutionary character. He considered himself a student of Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh's school. He tried to control the movement of revolutionaries with a series of changes. He released some political prisoners, most of whom were members of the Tudeh party. He gave freedom to newspapers and advertised on these moves very much. He gave a speech on TV almost every day, but none of his actions were fruitful and the situation was getting worse by the day. In the case of Imam Khomeini, he acted very cautiously. He always expressed interest in the clergy and sent many envoys to France to negotiate with Imam Khomeini. But Imam Khomeini was not willing to talk to any of them. Finally, he decided to go to France in order to be able to control the chaos. When Shapur Bakhtiar was on the plane, he was informed that Imam Khomeini would not meet him until he resigned as prime minister. Then he changed his tone little by little. The situation in the country was chaotic, and no one thought that Imam Khomeini would return to Iran in a few months. But in this situation, the news about Imam Khomeini's imminent return to Iran was published in the first days of February. Shapur Bakhtiar was confused and was all of a doodah. At first, he tried to take this opportunity from the Iranian people by besieging the airport. Tried to postpone Imam Khomeini's flight to Iran in various ways, but he soon had to admit defeat and try to adapt to the situation of his government to the return of Imam Khomeini.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
Turkish authorities have arrested contractors for negligence over buildings flattened by recent earthquakes. Turkey's justice minister has vowed to take action against negligence and flaws after deadly earthquakes flattened more than 6,000 buildings in southeast of the country. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Turkey's TRT World has covered this story and tells us more. Turkish authorities have begun to arrest contractors over buildings that collapsed after two deadly earthquakes jolted southeastern Turkey and northern Syria. The role of 131 suspects relating to the buildings collapsed in the earthquake has been determined, the Turkish Vice President Fuat Oktay said late on Saturday. He said one of them has been arrested and detention orders have been announced for 113 others. Earlier, police arrested Hasan Alpargun in the Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus after some buildings made by his construction company collapsed in the southern Adana province, according to security forces. Prosecutors issued an arrest warrant for Alpargun on suspicion of reckless manslaughter and other charges. Contractor Ibrahim Mustafa Unkurlu was arrested in Istanbul after technical examination of the wreckage of an apartment building in the Gaziantep province found neglect. Istanbul police arrested another contractor, Mehmet Ertan Akay, after his building collapsed during the earthquake in Gaziantep. Prosecutors issued an arrest warrant for Akay on charges of reckless manslaughter and building code violations. Mehmet Yashar Kurchgun, the contractor of a large residential building in the hard-hit Hatay province, was also taken into custody. Security forces arrested Kurchgun in Istanbul airport on his way to Montenegro while attempting to leave the country. Kurchgun claimed that he did not know why the building collapsed and that his flight to Montenegro had nothing to do with the collapsed building. Turkey's Justice Minister, Bahir Bozdag, on Wednesday, vowed to take action against negligence and flaws after the deadly earthquakes, underlining that the priority now is to save people who are trapped under the rubble. Bozdag pledged, "After that, the judicial process will follow and all those who had negligence and fault will be held accountable." At least 24,617 people have died and more than 80,000 others have been injured in two strong earthquakes that jolted southeastern Turkey on Monday last week. The magnitude 7.8 and 7.6 earthquakes centered on the Kahramanmaraş province affected more than 13 million people across 10 provinces. The provinces include Hatay, Malatya, Gaziantep, Adana, Adıyaman, Diyarbakır, Kilis, Osmaniye, and Sandıyorfa. The Financial Times has also covered this story and tells us more. Turkish authorities have launched a crackdown on developers connected to buildings that were toppled this week's devastating earthquake. The Justice Ministry has authorized almost 150 local prosecutors' offices to set up earthquake investigation units to probe contractors, surveyors and other experts with links to destroyed buildings and ensure that they do not flee the country or destroy evidence. Turkey's Anadolu News Agency reported late on Saturday. In an indication that these legal processes are already underway, a contractor for a building of luxury flats in the hard-hit Hatay province in Turkey's south was detained on Friday at Istanbul Airport on his way to Montenegro, according to the Anadolu News Agency. Prosecutors in Istanbul ordered the arrest after finding his flight plans, the agency said. Turkish politicians vowed to investigate poor construction quality in the aftermath of the earthquake, which killed more than 24,000 people in Turkey and thousands more in neighboring Syria. Turkey's Justice Minister, Bagir Bozdag, said earlier this week that all those who had negligence and fault would be held accountable. On Saturday, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan pledged to erect hundreds of thousands of seismically safe buildings within a year in a massive reconstruction effort. "We will not leave any of our citizens, dead or alive, under the rubble," he said. "Then we will quickly begin removing debris and rebuilding activities. We are making plans to build hundreds of thousands of houses, of buildings and infrastructure, or rather to establish anew our cities that were destroyed in the earthquake," Erdogan said. "God willing, we will complete the reconstruction and restoration work within a year." Around 14,000 rescuers are staging a last-ditch effort to find survivors almost a week after the earthquake, but the situation in some areas of the country is becoming fraught. Two groups of German rescuers were on Saturday forced to suspend their operations in Hatay province over security concerns, with one citing apparent shots heard in the area. Some experts have urged the government not to quickly clear the rubble in order to collect evidence against property developers and contractors. Civil engineers have said many construction projects in Turkey's southeast were undertaken with insufficient protections against ground shaking in a region that is known to be vulnerable to earthquakes. The construction industry accounts for around 5% of Turkey's economy. Meanwhile, all Turkish universities will move to online classes for the rest of the academic year so that their dormitories can be used as emergency housing for those who have lost their homes in the earthquakes. On Friday, President Erdogan conceded that the rescue had not moved sufficiently swiftly because of the sprawling area that was affected, bad weather, and rescuers and their families also being hit by the earthquake, which was the worst natural disaster in Turkey in almost a century. Turkey's Anadolu news agency has also covered the same story. Turkish authorities have begun to arrest contractors over buildings that collapsed after deadly major earthquakes jolted southeastern Turkey. Police arrested Hasan Alparcun in the Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus after some buildings made by his construction company collapsed in the southern Adana province. Prosecutors issued an arrest warrant for Hasan Alparcun on suspicion of reckless manslaughter and other charges. Contractor Ebrahim Mustafa Unkurglu was arrested in Istanbul after technical examination of the wreckage of an apartment building in the Gaziantep province found neglect. Istanbul police arrested another contractor, Mehmet Ertan Akay, after his building collapsed during the earthquake in Gaziantep. Prosecutors issued an arrest warrant for Mehmet Ertan Akay on charges of reckless manslaughter and building code violations.